Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be talking about Southern fiction with novelist Michael Ferris Smith, whose latest book is called Rivers, and David Armand, whose second novel is Harlow. My guest today is Mississippi writer Michael Ferris Smith, whose new novel is Rivers. He's one of those lucky writers for whom the stars seem to have aligned this fall. This is a book that everyone's talking about, and rightly so. Smith is an award-winning writer who's honed his craft in short fiction and the novella The Hands of Strangers, and he's joining us from Columbus, Mississippi, where he teaches at Mississippi University for Women. Michael Ferris Smith, welcome to The Reading Life.
Hi, Susan. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to speak to the man behind the book, especially a book you can't put down. And Rivers is a story that all Louisianans will recognize. It pushes the Gulf Coast on past Katrina into a world where storms rarely stop. And I don't think I've ever read so much about rain. And that was important in the beginning of the writing of this book, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I decided once I was going to write a Gulf Coast devastated novel that I was just going to bear down as hard as I possibly could. And there were moments in the writing of the original draft when it would stop raining and the sun would come out, and I would go back and think, no, that can't happen. So I'd just make it rain some more and bring another storm. And I thought that, you know, was really going to be something that hopefully made the book unique. But it was a little wearing on me, too. You know, it was wearing to, you know, constantly have those storms driving onto the characters and onto the landscape. But I felt a little bit like Mother Nature myself during the writing of it.
Ah, the power of the writer.
Yeah.
Now, it's a truly amazing premise in Rivers that the nation would just draw a line across the southern portion and abandon it and abandon the people who chose to live there. How did that come to you?
I think it just goes back to the notion that I wanted to make things as extreme as possible. You know, I've imagined basically storm after storm after storm, Katrina-like storms for 6 or 8 or 10 years. And we all know what the Gulf Coast, Mississippi, and Louisiana looked like after Katrina. And, you know, in my mind, I was thinking, well, if this kept on and on and on, there would never be a break to rebuild. And at some point, you know, what do you do? And to abandon the region didn't seem that far-fetched to me. I don't know why I picked 90 miles above the coastline to do it, but I just decided to draw a line and say, everything below, you're on your own, and it's kind of like the Wild West, and then everything above, you know, we'll keep trying.
It was the wet Wild West, too.
Yeah, the wet Wild West. Yeah, I forgot that.
Now, one of the things that fascinates me are the range of reasons that people choose to stay behind in this battered landscape. I wonder if you'd talk a bit about that and your main character, Cohen, who is so unforgettable.
Right. And, you know, I think that's a good point. And that was one of the things about writing Rivers that I think really helped me as a writer, is because every character you would encounter down there, you would ask, why are you here? So I had to go in there and I had to figure out, why is each character here? You know, the novel's centered around Cohen, and Cohen has more of emotional reasons for being there. He suffered a tremendous amount of loss when the novel begins. He's already hurt and heartbroken, and he's very attached to his place. He's very attached to his family land. He's fortunate that he has a little short brick house that is still standing, but he's living with the ghosts and memories of his wife and unborn child who don't make it through one of the evacuations during a very bad time. And, you know, emotions can be crippling, and they can be very constricting to us, and I think he's dealing with that. And he's just decided, I don't care what happens down here. This is my place, and this is where I'm supposed to be, and he's just living with, you know, what used to be, and he can't get away from it. I mean, he's eventually forced to then deal with it. But each character has their own reason for being there, and I think even in the craziest disasters, there are people who can't leave for whatever reason, whether it be socioeconomic or whatever, but there are people who could leave but don't. And you always wonder when you see them being lifted by a helicopter or floating down the river on a, you know, piece of broken plywood, why didn't they leave? So I had to answer that for every character, and every character had their own, you know, strange reasons for being there.
Well, it's so interesting. I mean, and those reasons range from the power of memory, the love of home, possibility of profit, weird quasi-religious communities in the making.
Yeah.
And now you've referred to the opening of this novel. I've heard you do this several times. And your main character, Cohen, as a man waking up in a family home on family land. Why does that matter so much to you?
Well, I don't write much of myself into my fiction, but the dedication of the book is in memory of my grandfather. And my grandfather lived to be 90 years old, and he lived on his same plot of land out in the Mississippi countryside in a house that he built. Him and my grandmother lived out there for 50 or 60 years. He owned the acreage around it. He had his cow. He painted all day long for a construction company. Then he would come home, and he would farm in the evenings. And when he was 90 years old, you know, he was breaking down a little bit, and he just didn't want to leave. And very thankfully and graciously, he sat up in bed one night, and then he just lay back down and went to sleep. And he lived and died in the place that he loved. And so I know personally about attachment to place and attachment to land. And when I started writing this devastated region, I had an image of Cohen waking up in the middle of the night in his house on his land, going out to have a look around after one of the big ones has come through. And, you know, I just let it grow from there.
Yeah, it's very powerful. Now, you seem to have a lot of the basic requirements for a Southern writer. And you're the son of a Baptist minister, for starters, and that does something to the language, doesn't it?
Yeah, I believe that has done something to the language. I grew up in Sunday school. I grew up singing in the choir from the time I could stand and sing. And my mom plays piano. She played pianos in churches. So I was always around gospel music. And gospel songs and hymns are, you know, you learn the flow of language and the way language sounds lyrically together, whether you know you're learning it or not, I think. And, you know, the images of sermons and of Sunday school lessons and Bible stories are all filled with, you know, very powerful images. I mean, not just Christ on the cross, that's a powerful image, but, you know, Moses parting the Red Sea and, you know, Samson and the strength of his hair and the story of the Good Samaritan with the man left for dead on the side of the road. I mean, those are strong, powerful images, and those stories have arcs. You know, they have beginnings and middles and ends, no matter that they're short. And they're about redemption, and they're about temptation, and they're about trying and failing and trying again. And, you know, I think even through listening to my father preach all those years, sermons also have arcs. I mean, they have beginning, middles, and ends. And I guess while I was sitting there, maybe somehow storytelling was finding its way into me through Sunday school, and maybe the flow of language I really began to seep into me in listening to the music and seeing the songs and listening to my mom play the piano.
And you, too, are a songwriter. You perform with Mississippi James Redd as the Wild Magnolias. And I love how songwriting and fiction seem to work together. Don't you think it makes you a better fiction writer as well?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think it's fun writing songs and it's fun writing fiction because I think any good fiction and the writers that I love to read, they're very lyrical. When you read Larry Brown or when you read Cormac McCarthy or when you read Harry Cruz or Flannery O'Connor out loud, there's a rhythm to the language and there's a lyricism to the language. And I think good songs, my favorite songwriters, you know, Johnny Cash and guys like Ryan Adams and Jason Isbell, who I'm listening to a lot now, and Ryan Bingham, a lot of great images, a lot of great stories in those songs. I think there are a lot of similarities in that. And I have fun writing music and playing music because I get to write a song and we get to sit down and play it and we get to hear it right now. Whereas, you know, when you're writing fiction, there's a lot of quiet time when nobody sees it, nobody is reading it, and you're not getting any feedback. So music is really cool for feeding that creative impulse in me kind of in a more immediate way.
It's refreshing to make some noise sometimes.
Yeah, it's refreshing to bang around, too.
Now, you and I share a love of Elvis, and you have a daughter named Presley.
Yes, I do.
I think that's great.
Yeah, we've always loved that name.
Me, too. And I think it's a great name. And one of the things you've said is that having children has made you a different, better writer. I tend to think that my kids have made me a better writer, too, but I'd like to hear what you think about that.
It was something that actually didn't occur to me till a friend of mine who I trust as a reader, who's always read my work from all the way back in grad school, he said it to me after my first daughter was born when I was, you know, had some new stories and was kind of beginning to try to write novels. He's like, you know, your characters up until this point have all had these kind of escape fantasies, or they'll just pick up and go. They're kind of wanderers, which is what I had been up to that point. Very restless, you know, always moving here or there. But after I had Presley, he goes, I'm noticing a change. Your character's kind of sticking around now, and they seem to be dealing with things. And children begin to make it into my fiction where they hadn't been really in there before. And in addition to all that, becoming a parent changes you. I mean, you think differently. You love differently. You sympathize and empathize differently. And you change as a person emotionally, whether you know it or not. And that was certainly good for me as a writer, because I think I began to look at situations and actions and consequences probably in different ways than I had before, and maybe began to write stories a little bit with more complexity than I had before. I know it's changed me as a writer, because it's changed me as a person. Those two things will, you know, logically go hand in hand.
Absolutely. Well, we've been talking with Michael Ferris Smith, the author of Rivers. He's a writer, and it's a novel to remember. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. I enjoyed talking with you. If you want to go, I'm going back down south now. Come on, take my hand. I'm going back down south now. We see the light, we hear the fight. I'm going back down south now. All I want to know is how far you want to go. I'm going back down south now. I'm going back down south now.
David Armand was born and raised in Louisiana. He's a novelist who writes beautifully and powerfully about life in the backwoods and small towns of our state. He teaches at Southeastern Louisiana University, and he's the assistant editor of Louisiana Literature, as well as the author of the novel The Pugilist Wife, winner of the 2010 George Garrett Prize, published in 2011. He's here today to talk about his new novel, Harlow. Welcome to The Reading Life, David.
Thanks, Susan. Thanks for having me.
Now, when you look at the resume on the back of your books, it's kind of old school writer stuff, you know, drywall hanger, draftsman, press operator in a flag printing factory.
Yeah, a lot of people, that's one of the first things they ask about when I come to readings or talks. And they always wonder why I chose to put that on there when I have these other affiliations with the university and a small press. And my answer to that is I think it sort of humanizes authors, at least in my experience when I've read that about authors. Like, well, they can do these things that you don't really associate with being a writer necessarily. Real world knowledge. And then when you read my novels, especially Harlow, you actually see those experiences that the character has, and it was drawn personally from those jobs, those odd jobs that I held as a young man.
And now I know that being a press operator in a flag printing factory is dangerous.
Right, right.
Really dangerous.
Yes, in fact, one of the characters in the novel gets hurt doing it. He burns his hand. And I didn't have that job for very long. I learned quickly that it wasn't the line of work I wanted to be in, but it was during the summer. It was very hot, and we had to work these 10-hour shifts.
Oh, wow.
And it was just pressing these giant machines down over and over, and you could the smoke would just kind of emanate from the machine as you press these flags. And I would always wonder, where are these going after they come out of, you know, who's buying these, and whose house is it going to adorn one day?
What kind of flags were they?
They were just these little folk art flags that you would see hanging in the country somewhere in somebody's garden, these tiny little, and some of them were actually garden mats that you kneel down when you're in your garden. And they're very cute.
Made at great effort,
yes,
though.
Yes, yes.
So how did you move on into writing? Did you always know you were going to be a writer? How did you find your path?
I think ever since I was a kid, I've always been fascinated by stories. I've always loved to hear stories. I've always loved to tell stories. And of course, read. And when I was probably about second grade, I started drawing comic strips. And I entered a contest when I was in second grade for the Just Say No campaign, which was real big when I was a kid in the 80s. And I won. and I won $100 for this comic strip. And then they hung it up at the parish fair in Covington. And I think that's when the bug first sort of bit me. And I realized, wow, I could tell stories that people like and they want to look at them. And of course, this was a different form. But yeah, I'd always fill up little notebooks with little scary stories that I would think of when I was a kid. And then as I got older, the more exposed I became to literature, the more I wanted to write like those things that I was reading.
Right.
So it was just kind of a natural. And I don't know, I'm the only writer as far as I know in my family, so I don't know where that came from exactly. But yeah, ever since I was young, I've always just...
But you've staked out this particular territory for yourself. I mean, these are small towns and difficult characters.
Yes.
What draws you back to these places?
Well, I grew up in a place very similar to the places I write about. I grew up in Folsom, which is not far from Sun and Bogalusa. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, I knew a lot of people who actually lived in these towns. And when I was writing my first novel, I sort of adopted that Faulknerian idea of having my own little postage stamp of soil.
Right.
And I don't think, you know, I'm about halfway through a third novel right now, and it takes place in the same locale. And I don't, just like Faulkner said, I don't think I could ever exhaust that little piece of soil. There's so many characters, there's so many places, and place is a character there. When you drive through that country, it almost has a life of its own. So I just knew that I had to, if I were going to be successful, I had to write about, to use a cliche, you know, I had to write about what I knew, and that's what I knew.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately and unfortunately, I guess.
And you staked out a particular kind of character.
Yes.
They're kind of down on their luck. They're hard up against it economically. They've been, a lot of times they're cast out on their own.
Right. Yeah, and that's again, whether fortunately or unfortunately, those are the sorts of people I grew up with and the people I knew. You know, a lot of the people I went to school with didn't finish or ended up in worse predicaments than just not finishing school.
Right.
And so it was very commonplace to me. But then there would be those few people who would sort of make it out, and there was always that sense of hope. I mean, like, my novels are very dark. My writing can be very dark, but I hope that there is a sense of hope by the end, that they can, in their own small way, sort of overcome these tribulations that they experience, because I certainly have, you know, and there mm-hmm. are certainly, you know, autobiographical elements in the books.
Well, Harlow takes as its driving force that classical search of a son for a father.
Right. Right. Yes, that's definitely a conscious decision to kind of explore that archetype. And I was actually, I sort of criticized in a review of The Pugilist's Wife, that the reviewer said, Armand traffics in cliches, and which I could understand how someone would read it that way. But at the same time, I thought, well, these aren't cliches. These are sort of these archetypal themes that I'm trying to put my own spin on. Yeah. So, I mean, that is a classic. You know, the son searching for his father, you know, you see it in Oedipus and the Odyssey, you know, the man returning home.
Well, and the search for the father is, this young boy has such hope.
Right.
He really does
right.
all the way through.
Right.
And you want things to go well for
yeah,
him.
Yeah.
You really do.
I know.
So I wonder if you'd read the beginning of Harlow for
sure,
us.
Sure, sure. It was dark. The boy lay down in a swale and rolled the flannel shirt he had been wearing into a cigarette-shaped pillow and placed it under his head. He closed his eyes and tried to sleep as the crickets played a steady hum in the woods around him. A car occasionally drove over the gravel road beyond him, throwing rocks and dirt down and over near the ditch bank where the boy lay shivering now, the red clay loosening from the embankment and powdering the boy's clothes and skin a strange ochre. He tucked his knees into his chest and rubbed his cheek against the warm flannel and looked peripherally at the clear winter sky overhead. Each white star and the full white moon seemed holes punched into the myriad blackness surrounding everything. The only thing darker, more black, the pine trees jutting from the ground like crooked black teeth against the cold and hollow mouth of sky behind them. The boy put his face into the shirt and thought about his father, whom he had never met. His father's name was Harlow Cagwin, and he had been living in Greensburg, Louisiana, the boy's whole life, and now the boy was going to find him. He would walk from Sun, Louisiana, and head west through all the small towns until he got to Greensburg, thinking, I will look just like him. Then he would look for the name, Cagwin Harlow. He imagined it painted on a mailbox. In his mind, the mailbox would be black, and the painted name would be in crooked white letters. this is how he saw it.
I love it. It's classic Southern fiction, isn't
Thanks.
It?
It's definitely in the vein of the Southern Gothic.
Mm-hmm. And where do you get these names? My
God. That was actually one of the most interesting stories. Names, of course, are very important to me
yes.
as a writer. You know, they say a lot about a character. And, of course, the boy's name is Leslie, which when I was writing his character, I intentionally wanted to give him this sort of name that could be either for a male or a female. And of course, he would associate it with being a female, which he would associate with being weak, you know,
right.
because he wants to be a man. You know, he wants to understand about hunting and fishing. And he has these kind of ideas about what it's like or what it's supposed to be like to be a man. And of course, he's looking for his father to do these things for him. And so I was writing the novel and I kept trying to think, well, what is this boy's father's name? You know, I had a picture of how he looked in my mind. And I had an idea of what type of man he was, but I couldn't think of the perfect name for him. And one day, you know, these sorts of things, I don't know how they happen. Maybe it's synchronicity, but I was in the dentist's office of all places. And I was thumbing through a National Geographic and there was an article about a man whose name was Harlow Cagwin.
Wow.
And he was losing his farm to developers. And he just was this very strong-willed, sort of grizzled-looking guy. And so I wrote it down quickly, and I always keep notes about things. And so I kept that, and I based it no way off of the real man, but just used his name. And oddly enough, I wrote a blog about where I got that name from. And the man who had taken the photographs for National Geographic somehow came across my blog, and he's a Pulitzer Prize winning photographer, and he emailed me and he said, this is wonderful, you know, and Harlow Cagwin, the real Harlow Cagwin, had just passed away.
Oh.
And his wife is still alive, and he said, when your book comes out, can you please mail Jean, that's her name, Jean and Harlow, could you please mail her a copy of your book, because she would love to have it. This is just one more piece of his story.
Yeah.
So it's just very fortuitous and odd how these things happen, but that's where the name came from.
The universe gives you little gifts
yes,
when you're open to them. You know,
I think when you're open to them,
out.
Yes, definitely, definitely.
Oh, that's amazing. Now, these are two, The Pugilist Wife and Harlow, they're both beautiful, beautiful books published by the Texas Review Press. What has your publishing experience been like with them?
I have zero complaints. They have been just very wonderful as far as giving me complete control over the design, the cover design, which is virtually unheard of. So they have given me the control with that. And as far as editorial control, they've given me a lot of leeway. I do a lot of sort of experimental things with my prose, you know, the minimal use of punctuation and that sort of thing. And they, I think, took a chance at allowing that to go out that way. But they were very kind in giving me that artistic control as well. So they've been great.
Well, they look like Louisiana, but more importantly, they read like Louisiana,
well,
too,
you
know?
Thank you.
Well, we've been talking with David Armand, whose new novel is Harlow. It will keep you turning those pages till the very last one. Thank you so much, David.
Thanks, Susan. It's my pleasure.
What's on tap in the literary life this week? The last week in September is Banned Books Week, so come on out and hear some readings from some of your favorite banned books. Staff and visitors will be reading at the Algiers Regional Library Saturday, September 24th from 2 to 4. I'll be reading at that event. And there will be another Banned Books event featuring Mark Foles, Lauren Godin, Denise McConduit, and Greg Heron, Sunday, September 29th at 3 at the La Nuit Comedy Club, 5039 Ferret Street. Today's guest, David Armand, reads from and signs Harlow, Tuesday, September 24th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books, and again Wednesday, September 25th at 6 at the Publication Party for Louisiana Cultural Vistas. That's at the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, 938 Lafayette Street. Kit Wohl discusses and signs New Orleans Classic Celebrations, Tuesday, September 24th from 6 to 8 at Garden District Bookshop at the meeting of the Cookbook Club. Mary Lynn Hattican, director of the Jefferson Parish Library, will provide an update on the library survey and other projects, Wednesday, September 25th at 1 at the meeting of the Friends of the Jefferson Public Library at East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. State Poet Laureate Ava Lavelle Heyman appears Wednesday, September 25th at 6 at the publication party for Louisiana Cultural Vistas at the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, 938 Lafayette Street. She also signs her new collection, Eldest Daughter, Thursday, September 26th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Best-selling co-authors Catherine Coulter and J.T. Ellison will sign their new book, The Final Cut, about an international jewel theft, Thursday, September 26th at 11 at Adler's Jewelry, 722 Canal Street. Michael Allen Zell's play, What Do You Say to a Shadow?, set in a French Quarter bookshop, is entering its final weekend at the Shadowbox Theater, 2400 St. Claude Avenue, with performances at 7:30 Friday and 7 Saturday and Sunday. For information, call 504-298-8676 or visit theshadowboxtheater.com. Valerie Hart signs House Proud, Unique Home Design, Louisiana, Friday, September 27th at 5:30 at the Contemporary Arts Center. Jasmine Ward reads from and signs The Men We Reaped, Friday, September 27th at 6 at Octavia Books. Jonelle Kelly and Robin Hill, who write as Joan Rylan, sign their third book, Big Easy Escapade, Friday, September 27th from 6 to 8 at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple. And Poppy Jooker signs Louisiana Eats, Saturday, September 28th from 11:30 to 1:30 at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. Janice Brown Carbone discusses and signs It's Time to Live Your Life Fully Alive, Saturday, September 28th at 1 at the Catholic Bookstore. Pamela Bennings-Ewan signs An Accidental Life, Saturday, September 28th from 2 to 4 at Garden District Bookshop. Denise Walter McConduit reads from and signs The Boy Who Wouldn't Read, Sunday, September 29th at 1 at Octavia Books. Rob Owen reads from and signs Spy Boy Cheyenne and the 96 Crayons, Sunday, September 29th at 2 at Octavia Books. Poet Delia Nakayama reads with musician Peter New, followed by an open mic, Sunday, September 29th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. The Algiers Regional Library has received a grant from the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities to host a family literacy program in the Algiers community. The program, Primetime Family Reading Time, targets children aged 6 to 10 who may be experiencing difficulty with reading. It takes place every Tuesday starting October 1st till November 5th at 5 p.m. Primetime is a 6-week series of reading and discussion programs, including sessions on themes such as fairness, greed, courage, cleverness, and determination. A discussion leader and storyteller introduce parents to the benefits and pleasures of reading and discussing stories with their children. And the featured reader in the 1718 reading series this month is Daniel Brook, author of A History of Future Cities. That's Tuesday, October 1st at 7 at the Columns Hotel. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.